This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Big news today, everybody. What you pretty much have to call a BAFO jobs report. Lots of jobs added and the unemployment rate is down. The Dow closed above 17,000. And oh yeah, we've got an interview with the president as well. Almost forgot. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 3rd of July. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We will, of course, dig into that jobs report on the program today. Our weekly wrap comes a day early because of the holiday tomorrow, as did the jobs report. We are going to start, though, at the White House. Our interview with the president yesterday about the economy, jobs, and Wall Street. When we got there, he showed us into the Oval Office. We sat down in those chairs you see in all of the pictures, and we started talking. Mr. President, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Last time we had you on the show, sir, March of 2012, unemployment was 8.3%. Great recession. Financial crisis were really fresh in everybody's memory. Now, you know, numbers are better, right? Unemployment's down. Economy's growing. Recovery's underway. And yet, for so many millions of people out there, it just feels lousy. And I want to know how you reconcile the headline numbers with what's going on in the real economy that people actually live in.
Well, first of all, people took a really big hit in 2007, 2008, 2009. We had the worst recession since the Great Depression. In some ways, the contraction was even sharper than what happened in the late 20s and 30s. And so people have still been in recovery mode throughout this period. In some cases, they've gotten back to square one, but that doesn't take away some of their long-term worries about retirement or saving for their kids' college education. The other thing that we've seen is that although the economy has been growing, wages and incomes continue to be relatively stagnant, and that's been a 20 to 30-year trend.
Right.
And that involves some structural issues that we've really got to work on. But having said all that, what is indisputable is that the economy is much better now than it was when I took office and than it was the last time we spoke. And that does make a difference. It makes a difference that we've created 9.4 million new jobs. It makes a difference that manufacturing continues to strengthen for the first time since the 90s. It makes a difference that we've been able to slow the rise in healthcare costs. It makes a difference that we have seen housing recover in many communities so that people are finally getting their houses back above water. So all these things add to confidence, add some momentum to the economy, but that underlying trend for middle-class families that they don't feel like no matter how hard they work, they're able to get ahead in the same way that their parents were able to get ahead. That's something that we continue to tackle and drives a lot of my agenda now.
I get that and I appreciate it, but I want to take you to the speech you gave earlier this week out by Key Bridge and many other speeches you've given throughout your presidency in which you said we have to grow the economy from the middle, right? We can't grow this economy top down. Now, setting aside the irony of you, the ultimate guy on top, trying to grow an economy from the top down, right? We sit here in an economy where corporate profits are up, but the money's not being spent, where the jobs that are being created are low-wage, low-skilled jobs. How's that supposed to work? How do you reconcile the disconnect there?
Well, there's some things that we could be doing right now that would make a huge difference. When I was at that bridge in Georgetown, Washington, D.C., yesterday, we were talking about the fact that we've got about $2 trillion of deferred maintenance. Roads, bridges, an air traffic control system that's creaky, an electrical grid that wastes too much energy and is highly inefficient. And we could be putting hundreds of thousands of folks back to work right now and not only put a big boost to the economy in the short term, but also lay the foundation for economic competitiveness in the long term. That creates a lot of middle-class jobs. The challenge we have is not that we don't know what to do. The problem is that we've got a Congress right now that's been saying no to proposals that would make a difference. And so part of our task this year and perhaps next year is to look at what can we do administratively or by partnering with states and local governments or by partnering with the private sector to boost wages, to improve job training so that people have better skills, to make sure that we're matching up jobs that are out there with people who are looking for work. And a lot of those steps are ones that are reflected in my budget and in my agenda.
We'll get to the Congress in a minute and your recent executive orders on the economy. Yeah. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I want to talk for a second about Wall Street and its role in the economy. The Dow today sits plus or minus 17,000, right? Mm-hmm. Record highs. Banks' profits are up. The big banks are bigger than they were during the financial crisis. Their appetite for risk is growing, as we've seen. And all of this is happening after Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill that we were told was going to prevent all these things from happening. It was going to rein in the banking system. So how do you look at the American people and say, you know what? Too big to fail has been taken care of. What happened in 2008 is not going to happen to you again.
Well, keep in mind that the goal of Dodd-Frank was to prevent another catastrophic financial crisis. It wasn't expected that it was going to solve all the problems.
But you get that it's small steps, right?
Some of these are not small steps. I mean, the fact of the matter is, for example, we have massively increased the capitalization requirements in banks. And what that means is that they've got more of a cushion. If they screw up and make a bad bet, they're less likely to need to be bailed out because they've got to have a certain amount of capital on hand. We have mandated that they all have what we call living wills, so that if they do screw up, there is an orderly process of winding them down and their creditors and shareholders are taking hits so that taxpayers don't have to do so. The consumer finance protection provisions in the law make a big difference in preventing ordinary families from being taken advantage of by predatory lenders of the sort that helped to cause the crisis in 2007, 2008. So those aren't small steps. Those are big steps. And relative to what's been done in other parts of the world, we are way ahead in terms of regulating the financial sector. Here's the problem. The problem is that for 60 years, we've seen the financial sector grow massively.
Yep.
Now, it's a great strength of our economies that we've got the deepest, strongest capital markets in the world. But what has also happened is that as the financial sector has grown, more and more of the revenue generated on Wall Street is based on arbitrage, trading, bets, as opposed to investing in companies that actually make something and hire people. And so what I've said to my economic team is that we have to continue to see how can we rebalance the economy sensibly so that we have a banking system that is doing what it's supposed to be doing to grow the real economy, but not a situation in which continue to see a lot of these banks take big risks because the profit incentive and the bonus incentive is there for them. That is an unfinished piece of business, but that doesn't detract from the important stabilization functions that Dodd-Frank were designed to address.
Would we be better off if banking was boring again?
Absolutely. And I've said that repeatedly. Some of the work to get that done, though, involves restructuring the banks themselves, how they work internally. Right now, if you are in one of the big banks, the profit center is the trading desk.
Right.
And you can generate a huge amount of bonuses by making some big bets. You will be rewarded on the upside. If you make a really bad bet, a lot of times you've already banked all your bonuses. You might end up leaving the shop, but in the meantime, everybody else is left holding the bag. Now, what we've been able to do is to try to prevent taxpayers from being the folks who are left holding the bag, but it's still not a real efficient way for us to run a financial system. That's going to require some further reforms. That's going to require us looking at additional steps that we can take. But you know, keep in mind that one of my key focuses over the last couple of years has just been to make sure that we've got a circuit breaker so that if certain banks are making bad decisions, they are less likely to bring down the entire system, which is what happened in 2007, 2008.
More from our interview with the president yesterday at the White House in just a bit. Also, we shot a behind-the-scenes video of exactly what happens when the White House calls and says, come on by, check it out at marketplace.org. It's kind of fun. You should know, by the way, that today at the White House, Press Secretary Josh Earnest was asked about his boss's talk with us yesterday, specifically that bit about banking regulation being an unfinished business. Earnest said the president doesn't have any specific new rules for banks in mind. He just wants everybody to know that we got to keep an eye on them. The eyes on Wall Street today were all looking up. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so about that jobs report from this morning, 288,000 is the number, 6.1% is the rate. It is also the jumping off point for the next 4 minutes of this radio program, our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal is in Washington. Lynette Lopez from Business Insider is in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lynette, let's start with you. Give me your gut on the jobs report. Yes, no, good, bad, up, down, what?
It was really great. There's no denying that. We expected 215,000 jobs to be created. It was 288. And one of the things that the Fed was the most worried about and continues to be the most worried about, and you'll hear this all over Wall Street, is inflation. That, you know, keeping rates low, the economy will get too hot. But what we saw from the numbers in terms of wage growth is that that's not really the case right now. So the Fed's going to continue its policy as is, and this is just a pretty good day.
Janet Yellen, Sudeep is just sitting back saying what today?
She's saying this is a jobs report that looks pretty good on the surface, and that's the key part of it. It's on the surface, it all looks good. It's respectable, solid job growth. It's what we've worried about for a long time when we see all the wiggles in the job numbers, and you're seeing a long stretch of pretty good gains. That is important. That's something we've waited a long time to see, and we haven't always been able to say that. But it still looks a little bit less rosy when you peel back the layers, and that is what Janet Yellen is doing. Too much of the improvement is still coming in lower-paying sectors. Yeah. As Lynette noted, we've got pretty weak wage growth. That's not good for all these consumers who are waiting for more money to go out and spend and boost the economy. And we've seen a huge number of dropouts. That's still a problem.
People leaving the labor force, right? People not looking for work.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah,
and
okay.
If we don't have people staying in the labor force, that's going to lead to longer run damage to the economy.
Lynette, can we, though, now finally, at long last, as the saying goes, put this idea that we're in a jobless recovery behind us?
Depends on who you ask.
Asking you.
Well, if you're looking for these solid jobs, as Sudeep said, these middle class jobs that the president is talking about, then yeah, we can say we're in the jobless recovery. We are still seeing those jobs that are lower paying, and that's an issue that we've been dealing with for decades, not just since the financial crisis.
Okay. So, Sudeep, turning to what the president said, actually, about how you grow this economy from the middle out. I mean, he did what he does, and he said the things he said. But how do you wind up growing an economy from the middle out when corporate spending is not being spent on hiring people and the jobs that are being created is, as both you guys pointed out, are not the really high-paying ones.
That's the key problem that we're facing right now. The president correctly diagnoses the issue.
Yeah.
We've all diagnosed this problem. Some of these issues are recent. They're cyclical issues that are driven by the depth of the downturn and the credit impairment that we saw. Some of them are structural, going back decades, as he said. And getting through that is a whole other story. It requires, in many cases, political solutions, and you're not seeing a whole lot of movement on the political front. The president wants to use the government to boost the economy, and there's a whole swath of America and certainly of Congress that doesn't want any of that. It wants to less government support than we have now, and that's true in 2014. It was true in 2013, 2012, and 2011, and it's probably not going to change anytime soon in the next couple of years.
So, you know, Lynette, the big media pickup out of this interview, I mean, it's been fairly buzzy all day in the business press, is was the bit about the president possibly thinking of more banking regulation. Do you suppose that means that banks are nervous and worried that they will be further regulated under this administration?
Banks are always nervous about more regulation.
That's right.
Under any administration almost. But what I think we should look out for, and I think the Department of Justice has already given us an indication that this is underway, is that authorities, agencies will continue to go off after banks harder than they had been before.
Yeah.
If you're looking at the settlements that have been negotiated over the last couple of months, the Department of Justice, the SEC, they're playing harder ball than they've been playing in the last 4 years. So
what took them so long, do you suppose?
There are a lot of stories flying around about what's going on internally in the Department of Justice, who's in charge, shakeups in terms of, you know, who's making decisions over there. And that's
right.
Another interview entirely. But but what we do know is that they're going after people harder than they ever had before. And we can also look at the state's attorneys general for that.
Right.
Here in New York,
sure.
We have Eric Schneiderman, and he has been pretty tough on Wall Street. Right at home.
Yeah. All right. Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He was in Washington. She was in New York. And we thank you both. Have a good weekend, you guys.
You
Thanks,
too, Kai.
Kai.
Happy 4th.
Right. You too. Much has been made today of the fact that 6.1% unemployment rate is the lowest it's been since September 2008 and the demise of Lehman Brothers, which is both good and something of a milestone. Question is, though, is a 6.1% jobless rate then the same as a 6.1% jobless rate now? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that slice of the job story.
We've now got back all the millions of jobs we lost in the recession, though that's not so impressive when you consider millions of people grew up and needed new jobs, says economist Harry Holzer at Georgetown University.
The fact that we've caught up with a number that existed 6.5 years ago, when the population and the labor force have grown way beyond that point, we're still in a jobs hole.
Plus, a lot of the new jobs are in low-paid industries like retail and restaurants. On the other hand, Holzer's optimistic some well-paying middle-class jobs will come back as employers see the recovery is here to stay. Darlene Miller runs Permac Industries Precision Manufacturing outside Minneapolis. The company laid off dozens of workers in the recession. Now she's back up to 30 employees and looking to hire a few more. And are things back to good for her again?
No, I would say the economy is slowly progressing. I wouldn't say we're back to pre-2009, but we are seeing improvement.
Jeff Kravitz, investment manager at U.S. Bank, does see Americans returning to pre-recession optimism.
They see that their portfolios have recovered, their homes have come back in value significantly. So they're feeling a bit wealthier. It really bodes well for like a nice, steady recovery.
And he says the economy's on sounder footing this time around, without all the overborrowing that sent us into the tank. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we have a very specific problem. We have a House of Representatives that is so ideologically driven at this point that they are not able to carry out basic functions of government.
The president on politics. But first, let's do the numbers. You know, that's funny. I was expecting the really happy music today because the Dow Jones Industrials closed above 17,000 for the first time, 92.5%, 17,068. Although, once again, repeat after me, 17,000 is just a number. 17,000 is just a number. The NASDAQ also up 28.6%, 44.85. The S&P 500 up 10.5%, 19.85. Three numbers made Wall Street smile today. 17,000 for the Dow, obviously. 288,000 as in jobs created in June. And 1 as in 1 p.m., the early closing time for traders so they could start their vacations before everybody else. For the shortened week, the Dow up 1.3%. The S&P 500 advanced 1.25%. The NASDAQ gained 2%, ended in the black for 7 of the past 8 weeks, rising more than 10% over that time, if you're keeping track, you know. It was an acid drop for the video camera company GoPro. Boy, I'll tell you what, after days of upward momentum, GoPro shares faceplanted 13% yesterday, another 1% today. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.64%. And you? Why, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Friday, the 4th of July. U.S. markets are closed. They even shut down early today. You probably have, too. Aren't you listening to this from the beach or someplace? Can you see a flag from where you are? Last year, U.S. imports of American flags were valued at $4 million. Most of those were made in China. And back in 1776, the population of the newly independent nation was 2.5 million, according to an estimate of the Census Bureau. Tomorrow, it will be more than 318 million. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Back to the White House we go and our interview with the president yesterday. Truth is, you can't talk to the president of the United States without politics factoring into it one way or another. What you can do is try to frame the question to get the answer to be something close to what you want. In our case, what the politics of Washington, D.C. right now mean for the American economy. So with that as background, here you go. Part two of Marketplace goes to the White House. Another culture question, the culture of this town. Your mantra this year has been pen and phone, right? I'm going to do whatever it takes with executive order to govern, basically. Yeah. And you have done that in immigration. You've done it on the minimum wage for new federal contract workers, all kinds of things. The question, though, is, and I understand your frustration with the Republican majority in the House of Representatives.
Right.
Is that where we are now, that it's one guy with a pen in this town who's running the American economy?
Well, unfortunately, we have a Congress that's broken down. And I know that a lot of times people who are watching what's happening in Washington sort of feel like, you know, a plague on both their houses, Democrats, Republicans, yeah, they're all the same. But, you know, none of them care about us. But the truth is that we have a very specific problem. We have a House of Representatives that is so ideologically driven at this point that they are not able to carry out basic functions of government. So we saw this during the government shutdown. The idea that we would shut down the government based on a notion that we've got to drastically cut the basic safety net, despite the fact that the deficit has come down by more than half during my presidency, it is not based on common sense. It's not based on any sound economic theories. It's based on the ideological predispositions of a handful of folks who are currently calling the shots in the House of Representatives. The same is true, we just recently saw, with immigration reform. That we have bipartisan support for immigration reform. We know that the economy would grow faster, that we would end up seeing $1.4 trillion in additional growth in the United States if, in fact, we passed immigration reform. We know that there are companies across the country, particularly in the high-tech sector, that are begging to have highly skilled immigrants who we've trained, we've paid for, and are now going back to their home countries to start businesses, stay here in the United States. Despite all that, we still couldn't get the House of Representatives to act, primarily because of politics.
It went by pretty quick, but you might have picked up on the president saying there that immigration reform would add $1.4 trillion with a T dollars to economic growth, an increase in GDP of that amount, in other words. It's a big number, a very big number, which deserves a second look. Kate Davidson has it.
Believe it or not, there are two $1.4 trillion figures the White House has mentioned when it comes to immigration reform, and they mean different things. At the heart of both is the idea that with citizenship comes higher wages.
We found that citizens earn between 50% and two-thirds more than non-citizens.
Madeline Sumption is with the Migration Policy Institute.
Most of that is explained by the fact that citizens are more educated and they speak better English and they've been in the country for longer.
But she says once you control for those factors, citizens still get a 5% wage boost or more. More wages means more spending, more tax revenue. The Center for American Progress added up the ripple effect of that and got $1.4 trillion in GDP growth over 10 years. Patrick Oakford co-wrote that report.
The $1.4 trillion in our report was more of a hypothetical saying, what if they got legal status and citizenship right away?
But of course, there is no overnight citizenship here. The Congressional Budget Office scored the Senate's actual bill with its longer path and came up with about $1.4 trillion in growth over 20 years. Manuel Pastor directs the Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration at the University of Southern California.
The numbers, the $1.4 trillion, look very much the same. But the difference is that one is scoring the actual legislation and the other is a thought exercise.
The CBO looked at comprehensive immigration reform, which is about more than just the wage effect of citizenship. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, one last thing from our sit-down with the president. Might as well use it while you got it, right? Here you go.
We do this thing every now and then with CEOs that I have on the broadcast.
Yeah.
Did it with Meg Whitman at HP. Did it with Tim Armstrong at AOL. And I asked them to tell me what their company does in five words or less. So, in five words or less, what's your job?
My job is to keep the American people safe and to create a platform for hardworking people to succeed.
It's more than five words, sir. I mean,
well,
I get that.
But I could have edited that down if I had to. I thought that was pretty succinct.
Sir, thanks very much for your time.
Really enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
If you can beat the president's word count, by all means, your job in five words or less. Ready? Go. Tweet us at Marketplace or leave us a comment on Facebook. And with that, we are out of here. That's Marketplace from APM on this Thursday. Today, the Dow up 92 points on that jobs report, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ jumped as well, 28 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 up 10 points, 0.5%. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, whose day, last day, by the way, is today. Dave Shaw and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Should have gotten Obama to say, this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.